Welcome back to This Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I am your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark, and I'm joined, as always, by the award-winning Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm dandy.
I am happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in controversies and controversies, is your TV lying to you? That is one of the propositions by Ian Bogost in an article for The Atlantic titled, Your TV is Too Good for You, 4K Resolution is a Sham. Bold. That's a bold headline. Not entirely inaccurate, though. Here are some absolutely true facts from the piece. All right. So first off, most cable networks and over-the-air broadcasts are not transmitting in 4K. It's 1080p, standard high def. Now, most TVs will do a little upscaling, you know, but for you to improve that resolution dramatically, you're going to need to get a different source. Right, we're basically dealing with the standard broadcast format that has accompanied the first wave of mass market HD TVs back in the early aughts. All right, so second off, many of us have TVs positioned in ways that do not allow us to really take advantage of 4K as opposed to 1080p. If you have your couch 12 feet from your TV, as many folks tend to, you're probably not going to be able to tell the difference between standard HD and 4K. The ideal location is something like 1.5x the size of your screen. So if you have a 65-inch screen, you want your seat to be something like 8 feet away, 7.5, 8 feet away, and at eye level. I just want to say, for the record, that's exactly how my TV is set up in my room because I'm a good boy. I pay attention to what they say on the internet. I can't tell you how many homes I walk into these days where the TV is like mounted over a fireplace and it's like 15 feet away from the couches. It's the hypotenuse of this right angle triangle is like 20 feet. Who knows how far away it is? Also, that just like can't be comfortable to watch TV. I just imagine these people like craning their necks up the whole time to watch, you know, sports or whatever. Sounds awful. Last but not least, there are some questions related to the quality of 4K streams. Some of the streamers are better than others, but the simple fact of the matter is that even the best 4K streams are going to be wildly compressed to save bandwidth. The difference between watching something like Oppenheimer on a 4K UHD disc and on Peacock is fairly large. It's just there's a big difference there. I will say anecdotally that I find streaming sports delivers a much better image than either the Spectrum cable, which I used to have and got rid of, or the over-the-air broadcast, right? Many Netflix originals look pretty good. They look pretty good when they're streamed. I got to give Netflix credit on that stuff. Certainly, they look better than their counterparts on Amazon or Peacock. I'm fascinated by all of these questions because one of the big arguments against theaters these days is, well, I got this nice TV anyway, so why bother going to theaters? And also because I get the sense that most people aren't actually paying that much attention to what's on the screen anyway, right? There's a reason that more than half of Americans under the age of 30 watch TV with subtitles on. And it's not just because of weird mixing issues, though we can discuss that. It's so they can kind of dip back and forth between looking at their phone and looking at the TV. They look at the TV, they see what they're talking about. Okay, we'll go back to my phone. Back and forth forever because nobody has an attention span anymore. Peter, are you annoyed that he ignored the most important part of any home theater setup, having 17 different speakers arrayed, perfectly measured distance, coordinated with the TV and your center channel, just to mimic the soundscape of a Dolby Atmos auditorium?
So I counted the other day because I'd forgotten exactly how many speakers I have that are part of my main home theater system setup.
You have I just want to pause here for a second. You have so many speakers set up in your room that you have forgotten precisely how many speakers you have. Is that what you're telling us?
Peter has speakers that are taller than I am.
Yeah, part of the problem is I have two completely different sets of speakers. One that is a two-channel only set of speakers that has monoblock tube power amps, and it's really only for listening to music. There's also a preamp and a phono preamp and a tube DAC, weirdly, which is a kind of an unusual thing to have. And that system doesn't in any way touch the home theater system, so you can't play movies out of it. And so that's some other stuff. But then I have all these other speakers that you can listen to music out of them, and I do sometimes, but are part of the home theater system. And it's nine speakers plus a subwoofer, which is a pretty good amount of speakers. I think I definitely could have more, but nine is not so bad. I like Ian Bogost a lot. Actually, he's a very fun writer, and I appreciate this article for the kind of dry trolling of it, right? It's definitely designed to kind of like poke at someone like me who really cares about home theater equipment a lot, has my television positioned almost exactly 1.5x from like the ideal viewing slot. You know, that it is raised up a little bit, but I think that's actually fine. Like when you go to a like movie theaters for years, like the whole point of it was that you craned your neck just a little bit. It's not like way high in the air though. It's just a little tiny bit of a lift. But I have some responses to his article. And okay. Number one is, who watches broadcast? Like what for what? I watch it when I have to learn about the news, and I frankly just don't care if Jake Tapper is in 4K or not. I care if his hair looks good, it always does, and whether he's telling me that the Republic is melting down or not, often it is. Otherwise, you should be watching Criterion discs on 4K. They have 50% off sales all the time. They just had one last week. Like, just buy the 4K discs, guys. It's not that hard. Number two, his complaint about the TVs being set up improperly is, I accept that. Like, that's correct. But that's not the TV's fault. That's the user's fault, right? Like, if your TV is in the wrong spot, then that's your problem. And you should put your TV in the right spot. But the thing he leaves out here is, yeah, sure. Okay, you go to suburban, whatever, like places where, I don't know, Sonny lives and people have big living rooms and fireplaces that they hang their televisions over. But in real America, that's not how it is. And by real America, I mean where
I'm sorry.
Live.
Wait. Hold on. I'm sorry. You're trying to suggest to me that real America is the DC townhouse versus the one-story ranch style home in the not quite the suburbs of Dallas.
No.
I'm much closer to real America than you, Mr. Suderman.
Can I also just say that Peter Suderman has a very nice fireplace, and I will not reveal everything I know about his fireplace because it would embarrass him, but he does have a very nice fireplace. So
it's a nice mantelpiece, but you can't actually put any fire in it. We tried. That was not going to work. Look, no, I'm not actually even talking about row houses. I am talking about tiny one-bedroom apartments populated by young professionals of the type that are springing up all over my neighborhood that I walk by every day. A lot of these are one-bedroom apartments that are 550 square feet. Like, that TV is not going to be very far from your face, no matter where you put it. And in fact, I'm joking a little bit, but that type of arrangement is quite common, especially mm-hmm. in big cities. And I walk by these little tiny one bedrooms that are being put up all over the city every day. I do a lot of walking, and I look into people's living rooms because there's only two rooms in these apartments, to be clear. There's a living room that also has the kitchen and a bedroom. And sometimes it's not even really two rooms. It's like there's a little partition between them. And it's not quite 100%, but it's far more common than not to have at least a 55, if not a 65-inch television in these little tiny one-bedroom apartments. And those TVs are almost always correctly placed. People don't mount them because they don't expect to be in those apartments for more than a couple of years. They've got a little couch and a little TV stand, and it's right at eye level, and it's, you know, 7 or 8 feet away from them. And they just, like, that's their sitting to hang out place in their apartment. And that is extremely common. And those folks have 4K televisions that are correctly positioned based on how far based on the size of the room and how far away from them they are. The final thing I will just say is, even if you buy all of these complaints, that's not a reason not to pick up a 4K TV. But also, in 10 years, all of this is going to be moot. Because the Vision Pro and stuff like this, and I'm joking a little bit but I'm not joking. If you talk to anybody who has purchased an Apple Vision Pro already, they will tell you that by far the best use case so far is watching movies immersively, and that the just watching a two-dimensional or sort of kind of 3D in the sort of 3D style of like watching Avatar 2 in 3D, like watching movies immersively on the Apple Vision Pro, everyone says that it is just an absolute transformational experience that people just like, that's the thing they show their friends. People just sort of they're like, whoa, they've never seen it like this before. It's just like, I'm in it, right? And that sort of thing is just going to become much more common. Maybe it's not going to become the norm for all three of us on this podcast. But I really think that that is, like, people are underrating VR as a movie watching experience and as a way to replicate going to a space with a gigantic screen and an incredible sound system.
Alyssa, my main takeaway from Peter's talk here is that sad single people already have a good setup and will have a better setup once the Vision Pro becomes, because the Vision Pro is ultimately an isolating thing.
Yes.
It is not, it's not a thing that you watch with friends. It's not a we talk about going to movies with friends and talking about it here on the show. And like, even when we go separately, we're still in a room, but the idea of the Vision Pro is to isolate. That's an isolation thing.
Yes.
And the one bedroom apartment, unless you are lucky enough to live with, you know, a loved one or whatever, that's an isolation thing. It's, I got my little pod, and I'm going to get my Postmates delivered to me, and hopefully the machine doesn't break down and stop bringing me things, because then I'll starve. Like, he's describing dystopia. That's dystopia. Alyssa, save us.
Before I save us, guys, can I make a confession?
Yes.
Yeah.
So my television is one that my husband and I inherited from the guys who owned the condo that we lived in before our house. I did not pick it out. At the time, it was mounted on the wall above a fireplace. I don't know the number of feet my couch is placed away from my television. We use a Sonos soundbar. I'm aware that you are all going to disown me from this podcast. And as a result, I just want to say how much I have loved spending almost 5 years making episodes with you. But the truth had to come out sometime.
What kind of TV? Is it a 4K TV or is it a 1080p? What kind of TV you got there? Do you even know? Do you know the brand? The size?
I can go look it up. It's 65 inches. It is not 4K. It's at least 9 years old.
I believe actually it is a 4K television. I believe it's an early 4K television. It's not an OLED. It's whatever was the top LED LED technology that wasn't OLED at, back in like the right around the transition between plasma to OLED. So it was the other thing that was in circulation.
LED. Before. There was the
just,
LED.
Just LED, I guess, before QLEDs.
QLEDs. OLEDs.
Right? Don't like.
We're getting in the weeds. It doesn't really matter here. But
it actually is a 4K TV.
Yeah. Yeah. But so I'm basically like, I'm the sort of normie television owner who like, probably is committing all of the sins. You know, I don't own a 4K player, but now that I know that my TV probably is 4K, maybe I'll get one. We have held off on upgrading in part because our children are, especially my son, are basically like the human incarnations of Calvin and Hobbes, and we want to wait until they're not going to destroy like an OLED to get an OLED. But yeah, I commit a lot of these sins. And I mean, maybe this is an argument against spending so much money on these televisions, but the price on them is also coming down fairly rapidly, as far as I can tell. And so to a certain extent, I don't really care if my TV is too good for me. It mostly seems like an opportunity to educate people about like what their TVs can do for them and encourage them to buy a 4K player, shop the Criterion Collection, you know, tweak the setting that's going to make things better. But yeah, my TV is a, you know, the thing that my husband and I use to watch Tokyo Vice and Shogun and to show our kids Cars and sometimes to watch other things. But a lot of my transcendent viewing experiences happen in theaters, and both of those things are communal in a different way. And that's great. I will, you know, I will try to do better so you guys don't actually boot me off the podcast. But
You can always come and watch a movie here, Alyssa.
It's magical.
Golden ticket, universal invitation.
Here's the thing, though. This is why I think the article we're discussing here is basically right in this sense, which is that most people don't actually understand how their TVs work or what they're getting. They just turn it on and they're like, I want to watch HBO Max, and whatever they see is fine for them. Like, I'll be honest, how do I put this without sounding deranged? I care a lot.
It's okay.
I care a lot about how the image on my TV looks. And even I will sometimes have trouble telling the difference between a 4K disc with the full HDR thing going, and, you know, in Dolby Vision with Dolby Atmos, and, you know, I can tweak the settings and see some minor differences, but I don't get as much out of this as some people do. That said, there's a reason I buy a lot of home movies on discs, and that's because I cannot stand how a lot of stuff looks on streaming. I don't like the compression of the colors. There's always these banding effects. Everything looks just slightly janky. It looks like watching an upconverted DVD on my old, you know, Blu-ray player or something. I don't like how it looks. I like how the uncompressed or the less compressed versions of these things look, and I'm willing to pay a little more for that. I think most people aren't. This is why my grand theory on customer behavior is that people don't actually care about how things look. They care about cost and getting them quickly and instantly, right? This is why streaming has defeated home video, is because people just want to watch something. They don't really care how it looks.
I agree with that. And as much as I like started by like saying, oh, 4K discs are the thing, why would you watch anything else? I watch a ton of streaming. I buy many fewer discs than I used to. And I don't think that the difference between a 4K stream and a 4K disc is large enough that most people will care. And that's fine, actually. It just, that doesn't bother me.
Yeah. And I mean, I also think that's true of so many kinds of consumer technology, right? I mean, do most people actually know how to use the multiple cameras on the higher end iPhones in the sort of maximally interesting way to produce the best possible photography? Absolutely not, right? I mean, it's cool that the camera will do a lot of the correction for you and just sort of capture more information and make your images better. But nobody walks around being like, you know, the iPhone is too good for that grandma who's just like taking some pictures of her kids. You know, I mean, we're being sold all sorts of like, you know, I don't optimize my dishwasher to like the absolute max that I possibly could.
Oh, man. Have you ever gotten on the dishwasher forums where people are so mad about how everyone doesn't optimize the settings on their dishwasher properly?
I should confess also that like the reason I don't optimize our dishwasher is because my husband does the dishes and therefore is the person who knows everything about our dishwasher. But I mean, all of our consumer technology is too good for us to a certain extent. And I suspect that sort of the cost benefit ratio on TVs is actually less bad than on some of the other things that we spend a lot of money on.
The one thing I want to say here as we close out, though, is that listeners to this podcast will care about this. And you guys should, if you are listening to this podcast, you like movies, I assume. And you think of it like you like the art of movies. And one thing that I think even people who know a lot about movies, who watch a lot of movies, underrate is just how much time filmmakers spend futzing with incredibly small details of image quality. If you guys remember that Brad Pitt science fiction movie Ad Astra that came out in late summer 2019, I believe we watched it for the podcast.
With
the crazed monkey and the sad dad problems, Tommy Lee Jones shows up.
Sad dadstra.
Actually, it's a beautiful movie. And that movie was serially delayed. James Gray gave an interview at one point during the delay process where he talked about sitting in a room for 6 months with a laser pointer, just going over shots and just circling little tiny, this corner of this shot, this color on this part of this object in this shot has to be different. And then they would go and they would change it. And it was 600 shots. And that's what he spent 6 months of his life doing, was just obsessing over every little tiny detail. Now, not every single production is quite that obsessively crafted. At the same time, even movies that don't look all that great, there's somebody who's sitting there doing the color timing and doing the post-production to try and make this stuff look really, really, really good, spending even doing the pre-production, like picking the exact right lens and really thinking about how this stuff is going to work and how the lens and the light are going to interact and, you know, with the different type textures that are on the screen. And if you're not setting up your television properly, you are missing a lot of that. And that's one reason, that's an argument for the theatrical experience, especially at a place like the Alamo, which does their projection properly. But it is also like, respect the film and respect the filmmakers and the time they spent on it, because they really care that is something they see and that they want you to see.
Yeah. All right. So what do we think? Is the 4K resolution revolution a controversy or a non-controversy? I don't know about this one, guys. I don't know about this exit question. I couldn't really think of a way to cap it. Peter.
Oh, I've already moved on to 8K.
Okay. Alyssa.
It's a non-controversy.
It's a non-controversy, I guess. Again, my main takeaway here is that, like, most people don't actually care at all about any of this. And I hope that the people listening to this do, Peter. We'll see. We'll see. Get some angry feedback here. All right. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our action-packed bonus episode. It's going to be a fun one. And now on to the main event. Dune Part 2. Picking up right where Dune Part 1 left off, we follow Paul Madib Atreides into the desert wastes with his pregnant mother, the Lady Jessica, and the Fremen, who are led by the worshipful Stilgar and the suspicious Shani. Paul must learn the ways of the desert so as to defeat the hateful Harkonnens, who have retaken the planet of Arrakis with the backing of the Emperor, and they got to get the spice flowing. Got to get the spice flowing because that's where the money comes from. Don't ask too many questions about the spice. Just know that it has to flow. Paul sees visions of himself leading a galactic jihad, bodies in the billions falling to his wrathful Fremen hordes as they spread the word of the Lisan al-Ghaib across the universe. These visions terrify him. He hopes to avoid fulfilling this destiny by insisting that the Fremen must be led by one of their own. You gotta get a Fremen in the lead there to retake Arrakis from the Harkonnen. Yada yada yada. Oops. Turns out, you got to do that galactic jihad. Otherwise, none of it can happen. All right. So here's the good. Dune Part 2 is properly epic in scope and scale. It calls to mind the sweeping desert vistas of Lawrence of Arabia, and the massive armies of something like Two Towers, or, you know, the big battles of Bravehearts, something like that. If you like your movies big, this is a big, big movie. All capital letters there. The performances are also fantastic across the board. Look, Javier Bardem as Stilgar sells the fanaticism of the Fremen believers with a sort of joyously silly seriousness that makes you understand how Paul could lead, again, the galactic jihad. The character's just written perfectly. It's performed delightfully. I love everything. Every moment that Stilgar is on the screen, I enjoyed. And every time he wasn't on the screen, I was like, where's Stilgar? What's he doing? I have issues with what they have done with the character of Shani in this film, but Zendaya herself sells the idea of Fremen doubt with aplomb. And it kills me. It kills me to say this. It absolutely kills me to say this, but Timothée Chalamet is pretty great as Paul. There's a moment about two-thirds in where he gives this big speech about discarding the old ways and how they have to follow him to victory. And it's the first time I've ever thought to myself, oh, I get it. I see why he is a movie star. Damn it. That said, for all the epic scope and grandeur of some of the big desert warfare, this is a movie that has difficulty tying the action spectacle to big emotional moments. There's nothing in Dune Part 2 that compares to the moment in Dune Part 1 where the Atreides clan that has been snuck attack and they see the Harkonnen forces streaking toward them, and then Gurney Halleck cracks his first smile as the bagpipes go and the men go to arms and they're rushing into a suicidal charge. That moment is like awesome. That moment is awesome, and there's just nothing quite like that. This is in part due to the paper-thin nature of the Harkonnens and the Emperor. The struggle in Dune Part 2 is almost entirely internal. It is Paul's. It is Paul's and Paul's alone. He must decide the path to take these people on, how best to serve and save them. And the movie is very clearly uncomfortable with the optics of all this. The whole white savior thing, lots of people discussing that. And we could talk about whether or not this is actually... We could talk about that. There's a reason the closing shot of this film is on Zendaya riding away from Paul rather than, as happens in the book, her kind of accepting her role as concubine and his closest advisor. On the whole, I liked the movie a lot. Look, I liked this movie. I enjoyed watching it in the theater. It is blow you away big. And I even if I like the first slightly better, this is still a ton of fun to watch. It is properly epic, though slightly monochromatic. I'm going to go see it again. I didn't see it in a proper IMAX. I saw it on like the Cinemark what their XD screen, whatever their big screen is that isn't IMAX. That's where we saw it at our press screening. It's not quite half a movie like the first, but it does end in a way that is not entirely conclusive. There is a holy war to come, and there's going to be consequences of that holy war. And I have a feeling we're going to get to see it after this opening box office weekend, but, you know, we'll see. Alyssa, what did you make of Dune Part 2?
I enjoyed it a lot. My friend, Patrick T. Brown, tweeted, Dune Part 1 is great, better than Dune Part 2, but it's nice to see a tentpole blockbuster hit the four major quadrants. Pro-life, pro-geoengineering, pro-experimenting with hallucinogenic drugs, pro-freedom fighters. And part of what I enjoy about the sort of resurgence of Dune is how little it maps onto our present political moment. And I'm sure there will be takes about Dune. They may be slower.
So many takes.
They will be slower to emerge than the Barbenheimer takes, just because not as many people are seeing it. Although I think it, doubled the box office opening of the first one. So that's a good sign. But I appreciate being in the universe that Frank Herbert and Denis Villeneuve have created for us here, in part because it is just so different from the moment that we're in right now. And I think this movie does, you know, a really beautiful job of putting you not just in that political world, but in the physical world, right? I mean, I think Villeneuve sometimes gets slammed as this person who's only interested in this kind of pulverizing maximalism. But I think part of what's really strong about this movie is the sort of small scale, intimate work and in the close physical spaces, right? I mean, you know, taking Paul and the Lady Jessica inside, you know, this Fremen siege, right? Where you have, you know, this very specific architecture, the sense of communal space, the sort of holy water that is sort of this reservoir of, you know, basically of like the water in dead Fremen's bodies.
The water of life.
Yes. You know, again, you have the sort of the temple setting in the south where you see, you know, Lady Jessica undergoing the like this ritual spice agony where Paul is later. You have all the, you know, the tents, for example, that you see get inflated and all of these sort of intense close-ups on Paul and Chani as they're having these big discussions about their relationship and this political movement, which are inextricable, but also just in this sort of inevitable tragic tension. You know, you have Jessica ensconced in this palanquin on the back of a giant sandworm. And so you have these, you know, sort of all this, these closed spaces, these tight little spaces. And Villeneuve just cares a lot about human relations, right? I mean, we're going to, you know, be watching and talking about Arrival together in about a month. And, you know, that's a movie that, again, is about the impact of sort of this intense maximalism, both in, you know, this the physical arrival of huge alien craft with a seismic impact on, geopolitical relationships that plays out in the form of, you know, a fundamentally small scale human drama. The question of, you know, this matters to us because it implicates how two people decide to have a baby and what happens to that baby when she grows up, right? So that slam on Villeneuve really doesn't make sense to me in general, and also just does not make sense in the context of this movie. And I would be curious to know what the two of you thought of the juxtaposition between the sort of intimacy with which the movie treats like Paul and the Fremen and Jessica and the way it treats the Harkonnens. And I'm rereading Dune right now, and the Harkonnens are cartoons in Herbert's, you know, in Herbert's novel, right? And it is interesting that the movie has sort of moved away from the, you know, sort of evil homoeroticism of the Harkonnens in the novel. But this movie feels to a certain extent a little bit unbalanced because you get so little. You know, I mean, the Harkonnens are just pure evil, right? They're Nazi. They're like Nazi gladiators who murder their sex slaves and are like super into knife play.
Yeah.
You know, it helps. I think it helps a lot that you see Princess Irulan as a person and not just as the person who's sort of providing, you know, epigrams at the beginning of all the chapters of Dune. And it also helps that she's played by Florence Pugh, who is wonderful and who I adore. But there is a sort of emotional imbalance in the movie. And I thought kind of, I mean, I can't help but finding all the Harkonnen stuff sort of aesthetically goofy. and I'm curious how that came across to both of you.
Peter, I'll kick to you in just one second. I just want to say, this is kind of what I mean when I say that the movie is, it's almost unconcerned with the Harkonnens. This movie, I think, gives real short shrift to all of the political intrigue from the novel. I don't think it's that interested in the backroom dealings between the Emperor and the Harkonnens and everybody else, because it is so focused on Paul and his decision that kind of just has to go by the wayside. The whole thing kind of unspools like prophecy itself. Like, this is, we know how this is going to end because Paul has seen it, right? And like, even though that is not necessarily how it plays in the books, that is very much how it plays here. There is no real dramatic tension between it in any of this. I also think, Peter, maybe you'll disagree with me on this, but I also think a lot of the praise for Austin Butler as Fade Rautha is totally overblown. I think he's a nothing character, kind of interestingly designed and, you know, well enough acted, I suppose. But the character is just a nothing character. People have compared him to Anton Sugar from No Country for Old Men or Heath Ledger's Joker. And there's just nothing. There's nothing that interesting about him. He is just there to be killed by Paul.
Yeah, and Leah Sado as the Bene Gesserit sent to seduce him, who and that character in the book, interestingly, is like Lady Jessica's predecessor on Arrakis, and there's sort of a pre-existing relationship there. Like, Sado has fewer scenes in the movie and does much more interesting work as this person who's managing this incredibly dangerous situation on behalf of a cynical agenda than Butler does. And I like Butler. Like, I thought he was pretty great in Elvis, a movie that kind of surprised me in terms of how much I liked it. I'm really excited to see the bike riders. But yeah, the idea that this is some kind of masterful performance is a bit of a mystery to me.
Peter.
So I don't think you're wrong that this movie gives short shrift to the Harkonnens. At the same time, I think it uses its extremely simplistic, almost cartoonishly evil portrayal of the Harkonnens quite well, because this movie is really focused on three elements. It is focused on the protagonists, the place, and the spectacle. And to some extent, it was simply necessary. I assume you, Alyssa, you talked about reading the book. Sonny, yeah. I believe you have read the book.
Yeah,
I'm not sure. This is an incredibly complex book, and just one that has been notoriously difficult to adapt, you know, going back to the failed Jodorowsky adaptation that didn't happen in the 1970s. David Lynch's adaptation is a total mess. Even the director's cut doesn't make all that much sense, just because there's just so much going on here. The Sci-Fi Channel version, Children of Dune, which adapts a couple of the books, is a little bit better just in terms of like delivering a bunch of the scenes, but it's a Sci-Fi Channel adaptation. It doesn't really deliver the kind of the spectacle that you get from something like this. And so, to me, I think it's pretty clear what Villeneuve was trying to do. He wanted to tell an epic love story against the backdrop of an incredible science fiction setting location. And then he wanted the spectacle of the worms. And then what he wanted to do, the thing that is, that I think is most clever and in some ways most under-remarked upon in the reviews I've read, at least, and perhaps I'm just missing a bit of this, is that this movie is doing a really interesting job, in some ways even more than the book, of subverting the hero's journey. And it's both incredibly obvious the way it does it, and incredibly subtle. You can read this movie as a rah-rah, Paul is the hero, yeah, it's awesome, he gets powerful and takes revenge, and that's it. If that's the movie you want to see, I think you can see that movie, and I think there are people out there who are like, yeah, big worms, kill the bad guys. And the Harkonnen's simplistic evil makes that possible, because they're so awful. So it just sort of makes the good versus evil narrative easy, if that's what you want. But then if you want to see this, I think the right way to see this movie, that reveal when Paul learns that he is a Harkonnen, that his mother is Baron Harkonnen's daughter, that Baron Harkonnen is his grandfather. That moment is the key to this movie, because that is when he embraces his destiny as a bringer of death and destruction. he knows what's going to happen if he accepts his role as a kind of as a messianic political leader. He knows that it will cause catastrophe, that he is not just leading the Fremen to freedom. He is leading the world to a meltdown, to something horrible. And he accepts that darkness in him. And if you notice the way that it's not just the way that that little bit is shot, but the next scene, we get one of these great sort of desert vista sort of sweeping things where Paul is walking and he's sort of like fuzzy in the background. And we've seen this, we've seen those shots before where he's silhouetted, but now there is a sort of hooded darkness to him. He's become in some sense, he's embraced the monster in him. And so this movie uses that Harkonnen, that sort of cartoonish Harkonnen evil to tell us that aspect, something of that is in Paul. And when he says, "I'm a Harkonnen, I'm going to do this. I'm going to lead the Fremen to...
We'll fight like Harkonnens."
Right? We're going to do this the Harkonnen way. The movie is telling us that he is accepting that to some extent what he is doing is evil in the Harkonnen way, which is the real bad kind, not the kind that, oh, you know, you can understand their motivations because, you know, everybody's got, like, they think they're the hero of their own story. No, this is a movie about how, like, he understands that he is accepting an evil choice. And that, to me, came through much more clearly the second time I saw this. In some ways, it's sort of previewing some of the and setting up what I expect we will get in the third movie, which I assume will adapt Dune Messiah, though it hasn't been, you know, I guess greenlit and it's not always totally clear. And also that is how I think Frank Herbert and certainly how his son Brian Herbert, who continued the series, has always talked about Dune and Dune Messiah in particular, is that these are stories about the perils of political power, about the problems that come with cults of personality in politics. And Frank Herbert was a speechwriter in Washington, D.C. in the 1950s. And if you read the introduction to Dune Messiah, his son talks about how, to some extent, this book came about as from his experiences in Washington, D.C., where he saw that politicians had these cults of personality built up around them, where they would sort of embrace, oh, this the story that was told about them. They decided to become the legend that their voters and their believers had imagined for them. And that when that happened, bad things followed in the wake. And this is that story. This is the story of how when the rest of the world says, oh, no, this guy is the one who will save us. He is going to be our leader and bring us to salvation. And you at first think, ah, no, that's not me. I'm just an ordinary person. I just want this, you know, whatever out of life. And then when you embrace that and accept the power, the religious and the political power that comes from it, you are making a bad choice. And you know you're making a bad choice and you're doing it anyway. And what that is that's like being that's a Harkonnen thing to do. And so I think the movie used that simplistic evilness quite well. And it does a really masterful job of adapting a book that is really, really, like, notoriously difficult to adapt. And to do that, it just kind of had to cut a bunch of stuff. And a lot of what it cut was like the boardroom discussions of the Chome Company, you know, supply issues or whatever. Like, just.
Yeah, but I mean, there's a critique of this film that goes, you know, they're all fighting over spice and it's not at all clear what it actually does or why it matters. Or like there's a line toward the beginning, it's like they need the spice to do the space travel. And like, I guess that's enough. I guess that matters enough. But it does feel very perfunctory and cursory. Again, the only real conflict here is within Paul himself. And that's fine. That's perfectly fine. That's a good thing to have in a movie is, you know, tension within oneself about, you know, what the right path is. But it does lead to, I think, some dramatic inertness.
Well,
overall,
it then balances out that the other side of that is the spectacle. And this movie does spectacle like just like very, very few other movies. If I were to name a handful of movies that do spectacle as well as this from the last 10 years, I think most of them would be directed by Denis Villeneuve and the other one would be Mad Max Fury Road.
Yeah, no, I mean, that early scene with the Harkonnens like floating up the bluff, to get away from the worm, or like fight that's taking place sort of beneath this, what I think is the spice harvester, where it's like got, you know, Paul and Chani trying to like run around and seek cover that's continues to move.
Where Paul catches his first worm, it's better the second time, and I loved it the first time. And that's a big part of what I loved about this movie, is it's so big and so loud. It's so delightfully, punishingly loud, especially in the... Yeah. And I'll say, I saw it in an IMAX laser presentation that was the first time, and then I saw it at one of the medium-sized screens at the Alamo Drafthouse. And it's really loud at the Alamo Drafthouse, so loud that when I was walking outside the building for the very first time, I heard the subwoofer like booming out the door, right, from inside. But it's the difference between seeing it at the Alamo in a very good, very nicely tuned theater and seeing it in an IMAX. The IMAX was almost so loud that I thought it was too loud. It was like pushing my personal limits, and I like things to be obnoxiously loud. I kind of loved it. And I love just like this movie's devotion to absolute maximalist spectacle. Like every 15 minutes, there's just the coolest thing I have ever seen again.
Yeah, it was okay. All right, so what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Dune Part 2? Peter?
I loved it. I've seen it twice already. I have tickets for a third show this week. I will probably see it more times after that.
Alyssa?
Thumbs up. Definitely a good parable about not obsessing over what your kid grows up to be, because maybe he'll turn out to be a messiah who's responsible for the death of 60 billion people.
Thumbs up. Good movie. I enjoyed it. All right, that is it for today's show. Many thanks to our audio engineer, Jonathan Seary, without whom this program would sound much worse. I'll make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode. Tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If you don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SonnyBunch. I'll convince you that it is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Friday.